Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great pleasure to be with you and to look at this overflow audience here, but particularly it's an honor for me to be able to introduce a gentleman that I've known for a long time. He's a good friend and certainly a person that I have great admiration for. As lawyers, we all appreciate the many responsibilities of the Attorney General. He is, of course, the Chief Law Enforcement Officer of the federal government. He's the legal advisor to the executive branch. And he has a special responsibility to the people of the country to be sure that the Constitution is preserved and protected. The career, the past career of Jeff Sessions couldn't have been better to make him such an ideally qualified person for this responsibility. Jeff, of course, as you know, started his career after private law practice. His public service was as an assistant U.S. attorney. And then he was appointed by Ronald Reagan in his first term as the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of Alabama. He later on was elected as the Attorney General of Alabama, and then had a distinguished body of service in the United States Senate, a person we could always depend on to put the Constitution first as he was considering the legislation before them. During the time that he has been the Attorney General of the United States, he has already, in this relatively short time, done a great deal and achieved remarkable results and accomplishments in the Department of Justice. During this time, he has restored integrity to the Department of Justice. He has reasserted fidelity to the Constitution. He has adopted or changed numerous regulations and practices in the department based upon sound principles, common sense, fairness, and particularly reaching a just result in the many cases and other legal activities of the department. And one of the things that has been most impressive is the way in which he has reestablished cooperative and collaborative relationships with the law enforcement community throughout the country. I don't know how many different groups that he's addressed, but it seems like it's almost one a day among the police organizations and other law enforcement agencies in all three levels of government, state, local, and federal. And he's done this with a dignity and professional skills that has been characteristic of his entire career. Despite sometimes partisan opposition, Jeff has persevered with courage, calmness, and grace under fire, and with an attitude of goodwill and also, fortunately, a sense of humor. When the Attorney General is introduced, you know, it's always appropriate to say the Honorable Jeff Sessions. Well, with Jeff, this is not merely a protocol courtesy. With him, it is an accurate depiction of the man himself. And so, ladies and gentlemen, I ask you to join me in welcoming the truly Honorable Jeff Sessions.
Thank you. What a fabulous group you are. Thank you. Thank you so much. You warmed my heart, the cockles of my heart. Is that what Churchill said? It is really, really great to you. And thank you, General Meese, for those special words. But I just was thinking, you know, I should want to ask you, is Ambassador Kislyak in the room? Before I get started here. Any Russians? Anybody been to Russia? Got a cousin in Russia or something. I was so honored to work for General Meese, and I was given the opportunity to hang certain AG pictures in my conference room, and you can be sure his went up in that room. And I worked for him, and I know the leadership he did, and they still remember, particularly the law enforcement community. We're part of law enforcement, if anybody wonders. And our duty is to protect America and have the back of our police officers. Police are the solution to the problem of crime, not the problem, and we need to know that. I told General Meese more than once, I feel like in this sense, at this time in history, it was a lot like when he took over after the 60s and 70s, and we had a serious problem of morale and lack of respect for police. So you've led the nation's fight, General, against crime, actually reduced murder rates over 35 years by half that we had when we started in the Department of Justice. And it's an important achievement for sure. Gene Meyer and Leonard Leo, you've had a fabulous run wherever you are. Leonard. Make no mistake, being able to celebrate with Justice Gorsuch last night was certainly a remarkable thing. And it was a near run thing, but President Trump delivered on his election, and he delivered on his commitment to the kind of judge that we all believe is the kind of judge we need in this country. So I've admired and appreciated the Federalist Society from the beginning. I remember the FedSoc back when I was a young United States attorney in my early 30s, when you got started, your two faculty advisors being a pair of DOJ veterans, Robert Bork and Scalia. What a good thing that was, and I remember that and joining and following your work. I never had a group around me, I don't think, to go and attend meetings, but I read the materials, you can be sure. And sometimes we felt a voice like a voice in the wilderness. I remember cheering as an assistant United States attorney when Rehnquist wrote an opinion, 8-1. And he stood firm for some important law enforcement principle. And I was wondering, could we ever change the world we're on? So I remember those days. Originalism and textualism were about as fashionable as disco. And but we had a deep belief in the constitutional order and the classical understanding of the role of a judge in the American system. And largely, thanks to you, we are no longer a voice in the wilderness. Today, there are some 70,000 Federalist Society members across America. They are in the academy, in the courts, in the law offices, in Congress, and once again in the White House. And in the Department of Justice, you can be sure of that. So there's no doubt, really. This is a historic thing. There's no doubt the Federalist Society has made an enormous and positive difference for our legal system. I cannot name one entity over the last 35 years, to my recollection, that has come close to the influence of the Federalist Society on a single important subject facing America. It's unbelievable, really, how much progress has been made. Your work has been the core of our relentless efforts to restore the rule of law in this great nation. And more than the rule of law, it's really the fundamental moral order of a created universe that's so ably advanced by our constitutional system. So what a difference a year makes. Elections really do have consequences. President Trump is appointing extremely well-qualified, highly respected judges, professional, skilled, brilliant, who will be neutral umpires, calling balls and strikes, not taking sides in the game. He's not appointing politicians or activists looking to advance an agenda, but faithful jurists seeking to apply the law, who serve, as their oath says, under the Constitution and laws of the United States, not above them. I know that's one reason the American people voted for President Trump. Like Ronald Reagan, he ran on a law and order platform and appointing restrained judges has always been popular with the American people. It's deeply ingrained in their vision of what the role of a judge should be. And we're generally on the high side, on the side of the American people when we talk about this. American people well know that activist judges effectively invalidate votes. Unprincipled ideologues want unelected judges to do for them that which they cannot win at the ballot box. This is not a partisan question. It's a question of fairness and fidelity to the judicial oath and adhere to the constitutional role that's assigned to the judicial branch and to the other branches. Judicial activism puts the prejudices and politics of the judge above the law and makes him into a continuing constitutional convention. An activist judge sits in judgment not of the case, but of the law itself, it appears, really, deciding which laws to apply and which ones not to apply. Whatever it is that activists dispense, it's not law. Judicial activism is especially disturbing in our country because we have inherited and advanced the most magnificent legal system in the history of the world. Indeed, the Anglo-American system is one of the greatest achievements in civilization. We have the oldest existing constitution in the world. It's an achievement we've been blessed to inherit and that we've been able to advance. So many of you have helped advance it. It's one of the main reasons that America is exceptional. History teaches us that such a system of ours, such a legal order is ours, is precious. It's rare. I've traveled the world. I've seen how hard it is to pass out a constitution to an undeveloped country and expect them to be able to carry it out. It's fragile. Civilization is difficult to build, but sometimes easy to destroy. In his Lyceum address, Abraham Lincoln said, "If we accept the small violations of the rule of law, then these violations will only become more frequent and more serious, and if that happens, it will still instill in the people contempt for law and eventually for the Republic itself. At the Department of Justice, we are committed to preserving the people's respect for the law by carrying out the law fairly and impartially." So I'd like to tell you about some of the work we're doing, including on the topic of this conference, the administrative agencies and the regulatory state. I can't tell you how much I want to express my appreciation for the staff that we've assembled to help us accomplish these things. I could not be prouder of them, and I see the anti-regulatory state Associate Attorney General Rachel Barr sitting right here on the front row and a longtime member of this group. Rachel Brand. Last month, the department finally settled 22 civil cases with 90 plaintiffs regarding the previous administration's improper imposition of the contraception mandate. Their claims were just. They had been improperly constricted in their right to freely exercise their religious beliefs, and we were pleased to try to bring an end to that matter. We've also agreed to settlement terms with nearly 500 plaintiffs in cases brought by groups who were targeted by the Internal Revenue Service when they applied for tax-exempt status based on inappropriate criteria. Criteria like this: if you used in your name Tea Party, Patriots, 9/12, or policy questions concerning government spending or taxes, education of the public to, quote, make America a better place to live, close quote. That was suspicious by our statements criticizing how the country was being run. They don't like that either. So it's also clear that these criteria disproportionately impacted, it's clear, the conservative groups. So the IRS can absolutely never be used as a tool against political opponents. I got to tell you, wrong. These wrongful policies made settlements necessary. The department has also provided legal counsel to agencies in this administration in favor of ending subsidies to insurance companies that Congress had not appropriated pursuant to the Affordable Care Act. I'm proud to say President Trump put an end to this unlawful practice. The executive branch has absolutely no power to spend money not appropriated by Congress. And similarly, no cabinet secretary has the power, through guidance letters or otherwise, to wipe out entire sections of the immigration law. But that's what the previous administration did with this deferred action for childhood arrivals, or DACA policy. Under DACA, without the consent of Congress, individuals here illegally who met certain criteria were granted not only lawful presence, but the work authorization and the right to participate in Social Security, which unlawful immigrants are not entitled to have. So no matter what one thinks about the immigration issues and policy, it cannot be defended, in my opinion, lawfully. So once again, the department advised and the administration put an end to it. And it's been ended. It's being ended now. The department is also restoring the rule of law through litigation. Our Solicitor General, Noel Francisco, yes, he's right. He's a member of this group. One of the very, very long time. The department is also restoring the rule of law through litigation. The Solicitor General has filed an amicus brief in support of the Colorado baker, who was sued for refusing to bake a cake for a same-sex wedding. Although public accommodation laws serve important purposes, they, like other laws, cannot be interpreted to undermine individual freedoms guaranteed by the First Amendment. That includes the freedom not to provide creative expression for ceremonies that violate one's religious beliefs. So meanwhile, I've changed policies at the department that support our mission of doing justice by executing the law. For example, we're no longer allowing so-called sanctuary city jurisdictions to nullify federal immigration law if they want to receive discretionary grants. We have placed conditions on these grants to encourage our elected leaders of these states and cities to comply with minimal cooperative requirements to assist in removing criminal aliens from the country. In June, I ended the practice of third-party settlements. Under the last administration, the Justice Department often required settling parties to pay settlement funds to third-party organizations that were not directly involved in the litigation or harmed by the defendant's conduct. We believe that when the federal government settles a case against a corporate wrongdoer, any settlement funds should go first to the victims and then to the United States Treasury, not the bankroll. It's not the bankroll, third-party, special interest groups, or the political friends, or whoever is in power. Nowhere does the Constitution grant unelected attorneys, even DOJ, wonderful sainted attorneys, or political appointees, the power to effectively appropriate and distribute United States Treasury funds based on political alliances and friendships. Neither does it give them the power to issue regulations outside the process of Congress's regulatory authorities given by Congress. Too often, rather than going through the long, slow regulatory process provided in statute. Agencies make new rules through guidance documents by simply sending out a letter. This cuts off the public from the regulatory process by skipping the required public hearings and comment periods, and it is simply not what these documents are for. Guidance documents should be used reasonably to explain existing law, not to change it or rewrite the law. From now on, at the Department of Justice, that's what we're going to do. I'm announcing today this process is over. So we prohibited all Department of Justice components from issuing any guidance that purports to impose new obligations on any party outside the executive branch. We will review and repeal existing guidance documents that violate this common sense principle. We will also now honor a directive that has been on the books at the Department of Justice since it was ordained by the man sitting in my right, Ed Meese, when he was Attorney General. I am ending regulation by litigation. The days of sue and settle, when special interests could sue an agency, then get the agency to agree to a settlement to impose, in effect, a new regulation to advance an agenda, is over. The Department of Justice is duty-bound to defend laws as they are written, regardless of whether or not the government likes the results. Our agencies must follow law. We're not entitled to make it. Judges in our courts must apply it. But as we know too well, some judges fail to respect Congress and the executive branch. One particularly striking example, it's a bit in my craw, I'll admit, was a federal judge in Brooklyn who heard arguments on a challenge to the federal government's wind down of the DACA. Outside the legal question, the court said to the government, to our government counsel, you can't come into court to espouse a position that is so heartless, close quote. Not unlawful, heartless, with respect. It is the province and duty of the court to say what the law is. I knew you'd get that. They are to apply and follow the law, not advance an ideology or express political beliefs. You know, we cannot allow unelected judges to set policy through an abuse of the adjudicative process. Comments on policy like these from a judge are offensive. They unfairly criticize an attorney who is effectively doing his job. Judges have the solemn responsibility to examine the law impartially. We're going to resist this tendency resolutely. The judicial branch is a co-equal branch. It is not a superior or a policy-setting branch. It needs to know its role. Those who ignore this duty and seek to advance their own policy views erode the entire rule of law. They set bad precedents and, importantly, undermine public respect that's necessary for the courts to function properly. An increasing number of district courts are taking the dramatic step of issuing nationwide injunctions, orders that block the entire United States government from enforcing a statute or an executive branch policy or order nationwide. Scholars have not found a single example of any judge issuing this type of extreme remedy before the 1960s. Never contemplated, apparently, by our founders. But today, in effect, single judges are making themselves super legislatures for the entire United States. We have nearly 600 federal judges, district judges in America, each one with the ability to issue an overreaching world nationwide executive order eroding the power of the President of the United States, for example. So the Supreme Court is consistently and repeatedly made clear that courts should limit relief to the parties before them. So if lower courts continue to ignore that precedent, then the Supreme Court should send them that message again. Enjoining the entire federal government is an extreme, dramatic step. To take that step because of a political agreement would absolutely be unacceptable. The Constitution gives judges no right to veto a president's actions because they disagree with him on policy grounds. So the media, by the way, let me note, only focuses, it seems, on decisions that go against the Department of Justice. But we also have some important wins. The Supreme Court has vacated both of the appellate court rulings against the president's travel pause. They're taking it on the merits, but they vacated injunctions. We've also successfully obtained before the Second Circuit a rare mandamus order staying a premature and abusive discovery order in a case to stop the wind down of the DACA program. Just an overreach. And I don't know how many times you've seen a mandamus on discovery be granted, but this one was, and we appreciate the appellate court for doing so. And so, although some district courts have initially ruled against this, I'm confident our positions will be vindicated in the Court of Appeals and, if necessary, in the Supreme Court. The President Trump has the statutory authority to suspend immigration in the law of any individual or group of individuals he thinks, he deems, are contrary to the national interest. His rational, narrow proclamation of a pause from certain countries that are dysfunctional and provide risk is justified within his powers as the chief executive who has the responsibility to protect the public interest, and we're proud to vigorously defend it. So before I conclude, let me say this. There are those in this room, and maybe more than a few in this room, who get frustrated about when they turn on the TV at night, you know, and you have to take Rolaids, and everybody's got an opinion about what the Attorney General should do or what some else should do. Well, I get frustrated too. A lot of things I'd like to be able to say and explain, but the rule of law isn't always about getting the outcome you seek. It's using the same fair process, pursuing the truth wherever it leads. We can never allow any part of our legal system, and least of all the Department of Justice, to be reduced to a tool for a political agenda. This department will not make decisions based on politics, ideology, bias, as long as I'm Attorney General. I believe that this is what the American people expect. I think this is what the American people expect and deserve from the Department of Justice. And we will not confirm investigations or leak sensitive law enforcement information to get a few cheap headlines. I am determined, we are determined as a team in the Department of Justice, to reestablish proper discipline in these matters that has been eroded. I got my page out of line. You have to come back to that. So in the long run, a failure to fulfill this responsibility can only result, really, it can only result in a perpetuation and a further decline in respect for justice in America. When anybody asks us to investigate a crime, we will take that seriously. That's part of our duty. We consult with the appropriate law enforcement agencies. We evaluate the evidence. We use our best judgment to make an appropriate decision. And recusals Well, recusals happen all the time throughout the Department of Justice and in private practice, just because we follow the rules. That furthers confidence in justice, doesn't erode it. So I believe that when the history is written about this department, it will reflect that President Trump appointed one of the finest teams ever assembled in the Department of Justice. The man at the top, not in the group, and that we've remained faithful to his charge and our oath. So I am so proud to work with you, to work with people like Leonard Leo, whose counsel and judgment I've always valued. I am proud to work every day with great people that we've selected, a lot of great career people also, and I'm proud to stand with you as we defend the rule of law in this great republic. Thank you so much.